This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier in the show, we heard from Chuck Schumer, the third-ranking Democrat in the Senate. My guest, John Kyle of Arizona, is the third-ranking Republican in the Senate. He's the new chair of the Senate Republican Conference and is the former head of the Republican Policy Committee, which shapes the Republican agenda. He was first elected to the Senate in 1994 after having served four terms in the House of Representatives. Senator Kyle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
You support the president's plan to bring 20,500 more troops to Iraq. What's your opinion of the non-binding resolution criticizing the surge?
I think the president's plan deserves a chance to succeed. And the resolution, while it would have no practical effect because the strategy is moving forward, would have a lot of detrimental consequences, primarily in the message that it sends to our allies, certainly to our enemies, and most especially to the troops themselves. And that's a matter of great concern.
Of course, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the troops think that the war is a mistake and that things aren't going well, and they might actually support the non-binding resolution.
I don't think so. As a matter of fact, on Friday evening, NBC Nightly News, Brian Williams, had a very interesting segment. With your permission, let me just quote from it. Richard Engel was the reporter. And he said, it's not just the new mission the soldiers are adjusting to. They have something else on their minds, the growing debate at home about the war. Troops here say they are increasingly frustrated by American criticism of the war. Many take it personally, believing it's also a criticism of what they've been fighting for. And then he goes on to quote from three of the soldiers. One of them says, among other things, we support the troops, but you're not supporting what they do, what they share and sweat for, what they believe for, what we die for. And he says, it just don't make sense to me. And then there's a staff sergeant who says, people back home can't have it both ways. He said, one thing I don't like is when people back home say they support the troops, but they don't support the war. If they're going to support us all the way. And finally, one of them talked about two of the soldiers that had died in their company there. And said, if they don't think we're doing a good job, everything we've done here is all in vain. So I think that's a pretty good representation of the views of the soldiers on the ground. And that's what I was referring to when I said we should be careful of the message that we send to those young troops that we put in harm's way.
Congress requested the report from the Iraq Study Group. And the president has chosen not to implement many of the recommendations from the group. Among other things, the group recommended a phased withdrawal from Iraq and dialogue with Iran and Syria to stabilize the region. Are you comfortable with the president ignoring some of the major recommendations from the Iraq Study Group?
I don't think it's fair to say he ignored the study. He chose to accept some of the recommendations and not to implement others. A lot of this is a matter of degree. The report itself, as you know, talked about a surge in troops. They intended for it to be temporary. I think the president intends or hopes that the increase in troops that he will be sending over there will be relatively short range as well. With regard to the matter of dialogue, we have conversation with people in Syria and Iran. They know what we are up to. We know what they're up to. There's a difference between dialogue and negotiation, and actually what the study group called for was negotiation. That's a very different matter because there you're expected to give something in order to get something, and I think the president's point is, tell me what it is that we're willing to give up to the Iranians in order to get from them what we need. And in fact, what we need is for them to just butt out of Iraq to stop causing trouble for American troops there.
But Iran actually plans on playing a bigger role in Iraq, including helping in the reconstruction.
They announced that they'd like to do that, yes.
Yeah. Now the president said that he's not considering an attack on Iran. Do you think, however, that is a possibility sometime down the line? And would you support that? And I should mention here that you co-sponsored the Iran Freedom and Support Act, which is subtitled A Bill to Hold the Current Regime in Iran Accountable for its threatening behavior and to support a transition to democracy in Iran. You know, when we invaded Iraq, we talked about a transition to democracy there. So the question is, do you think the president is kind of leading us slowly towards some kind of military confrontation with Iran or regime change there?
No, he's made that clear, although it would be very nice to have a regime change there. In the bill that you mentioned, does include some steps that we would hope would result in regime change, but it's not imposed from the outside. It's to encourage the people of Iran to try to change their own regime. There is a lot of support within Iran for changing their government, but their government has been very, very tough on people who dissent, and as a result, it's been difficult for them to effectuate that change. But I think it should be our goal to and hope that the aspirations of the people of Iran to have a more democratic government could ultimately bear fruit. But that doesn't come about through any invasion or attack by the United States. None is contemplated either by that legislation you mentioned nor by what the president has said. What he's basically said is if Iranians come into Iraq and they do harm to American troops, they'll be treated just like the foreign fighters from anywhere else. We'll deal with them in self-defense.
Well, you know, the invasion of Iraq was supposed to bring democracy to Iraq and then to the region. What you're talking about now, okay, if Iran helps in Iraq and we end up fighting them like we would anybody else who was interfering in Iraq, I mean, aren't we talking about the possibility of the war escalating through the region? And are we facing a situation where instead of the plan, which was democracy spreading through the region, that chaos is spreading through the region?
Well, there's quite a bit embodied in your question there. First of all, there have been elections in Iraq for the first time, and a government that is democratically elected is in place. And so there has been created now the great potential for a democratic government in a country, Iraq, that hasn't had it in its entire history. The same thing is true in Afghanistan. Now, we hope that the same thing could become true in Iran, but we're not going to impose that by any kind of an invasion. In Lebanon, you know that the people took charge there and have created a much more democratic government. It is, I believe, arguable that democracy is spreading throughout the Middle East, even though that's a relatively hostile territory for democracy, and it's not been easy. But I think you'd have to say that in some respects, freedom is on the march there. Now, with respect to the violence, of course, everybody knows the violence that's occurring in Iraq today. That's a different proposition than the concept here of trying to spread democracy. There are obviously people that are trying to keep that from happening, and they're fomenting the violence in Iraq today.
Do you think that some Republicans are distancing themselves from the president now in, for example, thinking about a non-binding resolution opposing the president's plan, even if it's a resolution that's more low-key, you know, less strong than the one that's already been put out there?
Yeah, I think there are a handful. You've seen one or two that support the Biden-Levin resolution, and then a few more that support the Warner resolution, John Warner himself being a Republican. So there are a handful who have taken that position. Whether or not it constitutes more than that, I really doubt at this point.
Let me move on to what it's like to be in the minority now in Congress. You served in the House before serving in the Senate. You're used to having a Republican-controlled Congress. So how is it different now to be in the minority?
It is different. I was in the minority the entire time I served in the House, but there's a big difference, as you know, between the House and Senate. In the House, the majority controls everything, and the minority are basically potted plants. But in the Senate, because of the rules here, where you've got to have minority concurrence in order to get things done, basically anything important takes 60 votes, the minority has a lot more power. And under the Senate rules, the minority has a big say in what happens. So our role here is different than when we were actually setting the agenda, but by the same token, in the Senate at least, the minority can stop things that it doesn't think are appropriate and can extract concessions from the majority in order to move forward on legislation.
So how does being in the minority in the Senate now change your party's agenda?
Actually, Friday, I will lead a conference of our Senate Republicans to establish our agenda for the year. And, of course, part of that is in responding to what the majority does with their agenda as well. And it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. I think probably Part of our agenda will be a reflection of what the president called for in his State of the Union speech. From the preliminary surveys that I've gotten back, for example, our colleagues are very interested in moving forward on the energy independence front, on providing quality health care for Americans, some of the things the president talked about in his speech. So I think you'll see at least some parallel between what he outlined in his State of the Union speech and what we've been promoting when we were in the majority as well.
You've described yourself as a conservative Republican, more on the conservative side of the party as opposed to the more moderate side of the party. Do you think that the balance of power within the party is shifting at all with the defeat of 2006 in Congress?
Well, I was up for re-election this time and had a very tough race. My opponent was self-funded. He spent, I don't know, $13 or $14 million of his own money, and it was a hotly contested race. Arizona has certainly changed in its demographic and political outlook, but I won by almost 10 points. I think that most, according to surveys, most Americans are to the right of center, and the Republican Party is to the right of center, and that's where I put myself. I think what happened last time in the election was that while people generally continued to agree with Republican principles, they didn't think Republicans were governing in accordance with those principles, and they punished Republicans at the polls. And you know, that's what ought to happen when a party or members within that party in leadership positions don't adhere to the principles that have historically gotten them elected.
What principles do you think the party didn't adhere to that it was punished for by voters?
Yeah, if you look, for example, at the House of Representatives, we've historically been a party that's seen as supporting the right kind of values in life and in government, and yet there were people caught up in scandals, and the scandals didn't appear to be handled properly. Congress has been viewed as spending way too much money. And Republicans had historically been seen as a party that was trying to be careful in spending taxpayer dollars. We weren't viewed that way anymore. I think people had viewed us as as competent, and yet the way that Katrina was handled cast doubt. We were in charge. Granted, it wasn't all, you know, Republicans, but we were in charge. So when you're the party in charge, even though maybe not all of this is your fault, you're going to be held accountable for it. And I think people want to get back to accountability on the Washington spending, for example, and competence in the way the government is run, and certainly high ethical standards.
Senator Schumer described the election this way. He said, in 2004, Republicans won with eight words: war in Iraq, cut taxes, no gay marriage. And in 2006, Democrats won with no war in Iraq, no corruption, bad economy. How does that sound to you?
Well, there's an element of truth in what he says. Of course, he was deliberately simplifying it, and I'm sure he would add a lot of nuances to it as well. But as a very generalized statement, I think there's some truth in what he says.
You were the head of the Republican Policy Committee when the party was shaping its strategy for opposing gay marriage. Is opposition to gay marriage still a priority for the party?
Well, I don't think we were... That we fashioned a strategy. People came to their own conclusion as to what they were going to do when the legislation was drafted and came to the floor. And I frankly don't remember a lot of discussions about strategizing it. And I have no idea what part it will play in our legislative agenda in the future.
Yeah, I'm just curious about this. I know you oppose gay marriage. Mary Cheney is pregnant. The daughter of the vice president is a lesbian. She has a longtime partner who she's not allowed to marry, but they are becoming parents together. Can you reconcile that for me with the position that the party has supported in opposing gay marriage? Because some people read this as being, well, it looks like it's okay for the vice president's daughter, but it should be outlawed for everyone else.
I haven't heard any debate about marriage with respect to the vice president's daughter, and I don't choose to discuss this issue in the context in which you've raised it. The vice president has eschewed that discussion, and I think I'm going to as well.
Yeah, and I'll just explain why I brought it up, because I know on some level it seems like, well, it's just a personal family issue. But it's a personal family issue for every family that has a gay person in that family. However, many politicians say, no, it's a political issue. There should be legislation. has the fact that the Cheneys love their daughter, their daughter's gay, their daughter's pregnant, that seems to be okay with the family, has that gotten you to maybe reconsider a little bit your position on gay marriage?
You know, that kind of assumes that I don't have any other friends who are gay or that who have discussed this subject with me, and that's just not true. I think all of us who represent other people, and after all, I work for all of the people of the state of Arizona, have conversations with people about this subject. I just had a meeting in my office last Friday with a gay man who wanted to see me and talk about this very issue. And he and I and a member of my staff sat down for about an hour and had a very good conversation about it. And he said, may I call you every now and then? And if you have any questions, would you bounce them off of me? I said, you bet. It's not as if we have to have this kind of a debate in public about a public family. And that's what I eschew in this discussion.
You've, on the whole, been very supportive of President Bush, but one area that you differ with him on is immigration. And you also differ with your fellow senator from Arizona, John McCain, about this. McCain had sponsored a plan that would offer many illegal immigrants a chance to become citizens. You want to see illegal immigrants sent back to the countries they came from, then given a chance to apply for legal immigration. As somebody who's been very supportive of the president, is it difficult when you find issues that you don't support him on?
The president, I've had many conversations, and I've certainly had many conversations with my colleague John McCain as well. Incidentally, on this issue of immigration, your characterization about sent back is not quite right in the legislation that I've introduced. It is true that what we believe is that people who have come here illegally should either participate, if they can, in a temporary worker program, or they, after a period of 5 years, should return home. But there is no deportation concept in our legislation. But maybe that's not the major point of your question. It's not hard to disagree with people agreeably. And certainly I have those kinds of disagreements both with my colleague John McCain and with President Bush. In fact, we had a long conversation just recently about this. And I think that what we have found is that we're a lot closer than sometimes the media likes to portray it. The problem with this issue is it is so hard to write it. You can agree on virtually everything, but the devil is really in the details. It's very complicated, very complex. Even the slightest disagreement actually can make it very hard to get something done.
Now, your father is a congressman, and I believe he first ran when you were in college?
I was actually a senior in high school. He ran in 1959 and represented the 4th District of Iowa for 6 terms.
He's still in Congress, right?
No, my father passed away
about
3 years ago. And as I say, his last year in the Congress was in 1972.
What impact did his going into Congress have on your eventual decision to go into politics yourself? Because you'd first been a lawyer and then a lobbyist. Politics wasn't your first profession.
That's right. I was a lawyer for 20 years before I ran. And what I ran for the first time was the United States Congress. And I'm not really sure in answer to your question, but I suspect that somehow or other it seeped into my consciousness that what he was doing was important and worthwhile. And that if I ever had the opportunity to do something like that, that I'd like to do it too. And when that opportunity arose, that's the office that I rose for. I actually never had a desire to run for any other office than the Congress. So I'm sure that his service in the Congress had that, at least that effect on me.
How would you describe how your politics compared to your father's?
Well, it was a different era, for one thing. He came from a district in the state that was more agricultural, and so he had to pay more attention to things that in corn farming, for example, than I have to pay to from Arizona. But I learned a great deal from him, and I think his understanding of human nature and the lessons of life that he taught me has stood me in very good stead in the work that I'm trying to do on behalf of the people of Arizona now.
Were there a lot of political conversations around the dinner table?
Not really, because, well, when we got together, but I was in college and then in Arizona in the law practice the whole time that he was in the Congress. So other than going back to visit him or when they'd come out to Arizona at Christmas time, we didn't have a lot of political discussions, but I suppose if I really focused hard or tried to remember, there was a lot of politics that we discussed.
Senator Kyle, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Senator John Kyle of Arizona is the new chair of the Senate Republican Conference. Earlier, we heard from Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York.